This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At state and county fairs, Main Street parades, and barbecues across the country this Labor Day, people gather to enjoy the last long weekend of summer. Amid these happy crowds move a chosen few with a different agenda. They're there to shake hands, dish out baked beans, and kiss babies. America's would-be elected officials are hard at work on this, the traditional first day of the campaign season. Of course, two particular candidates are hogging most of the campaign spotlight, but beneath their names, this fall's ballot will list the names of wannabe senators and representatives, state legislatures, city councilors, school board members, mayors, sheriffs, judges, even coroners. So what does it take to run for office, and how do you start? Later this hour, we'll go to Florida to hear stories of storms and survival. But for most of the program, we're going to talk about running for office. We want to hear your stories. If you've ever run for local or state office, what did you learn from the experience? And what would your favorite piece of advice be to a potential newcomer? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Robin Driscoll, and she's running for the state legislature in Billings, Montana. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
What are you doing today?
I'm at the Labor Day picnic in Billings, Montana, where all sorts of union members and family and friends have gathered to talk politics and help out with our election in November.
This is your first run for office?
It is.
How's it going?
Oh, you know, it's going great. The best part about it is getting out and meeting folks, and most people are real receptive at the door, so it's been a real good experience.
And is it more work than you expected it to be?
You know, not so much, because I've worked on campaigns ever since I was a child, really, with my dad, who was a precinct committee man, and so I kind of knew what I was getting into, but it does overtake your life completely.
It's a little like the family business, then.
It is. As soon as I get off work at 5 o'clock, I'm knocking on doors till 7:30 every night. So it's a lot of work.
And how many people, how big is your campaign staff?
Probably about 6 people that are working real hard on it. And then I've got tons and tons of volunteers that are doing anything from sign locations to phoning to knocking on doors with me. So it's big.
And after going through your father's campaigns and now one of your own, what's the most important lesson you've learned these past few weeks while you've been running?
Prepare. If a candidate is interested in running, prepare to have it overtake your life for at least 3 months completely.
And when you win, remind us what you get in the Montana legislature. This is not a full-time job, is it?
It is not. It's a 4-month, every 2-year job. So it's our legislature meets January through April, as long as we don't have to extend the session. And so then I go back to my work as a community education coordinator for the school district. So
this is not going to buy that second house on the southern coast of France for you.
Not at all. In fact, I'll probably be taking a cut in pay to do this, but it's well worth every penny.
Just on the outside chance that, of course, we all know your opponent's a scoundrel, and that's going to be well demonstrated. But
he's actually a very nice person.
In the unlikely event you do not win come November, what are you going to do?
I will just continue on in my job that I love with Billings Public Schools and do this again when I retire.
Okay, Robin Driscoll, thanks very much, and have an extra ear of corn for us, all right?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Robin Driscoll is running as a Democrat for the Montana House District 51. That's in Billings, Montana. We reached her at a Labor Day picnic here. Joining us here in Studio 3A is veteran political consultant Ron Fauché, a former editor of Campaigns and Elections, the magazine for people in politics, and the author of numerous books about campaigning. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
We just spoke with Robin Driscoll as you were listening to her. Any particular advice that you give a newcomer? She seems to come into this with more background than most.
Well, she seems to, and what she said about it overtaking her life is 100% true. Whether you're running for the school board or the city council or the state legislature or Congress or governor or president, running for office is a can be a 24-hour-a-day obsession for people who do it.
Is there any office, now, presuming you're not a retired sports star or military hero or something like that, but if you're just starting out as a young person interested in elective politics, what level should you start out at?
Well, you know, it really depends. I think people should run for offices that they want to hold. Don't run for something just because you might have a chance to win it. Run for
something
exactly that you think you can do something with the job. And for some people, that may be a city council position, a county position. It may be a state legislative position. It may be even running for Congress or something more significant than some of the local offices.
And is that time commitment that Robin was talking about, is that the biggest thing that political tyros need to be aware of?
The time commitment is enormous, even if you're running for a small office. There is nothing you can be doing when you're running for office when you can't be spending time campaigning. When you're brushing your teeth in the morning, you could be calling somebody for money. When you're driving your kids to school, you could be knocking on a door. There's always something you can be doing in a campaign.
What are you doing if you're running for office? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Nicholas joins us on the line from Wichita, Kansas.
Yes, I had just returned from overseas in 1975 after 5 years over there in basically in Africa and the third world countries. At that time, I came back filled with the fervor of how much better a system we had than anywhere else, and I'd been in Europe as well, and so decided to run for state senate. I think your earlier comment about that 100% time commitment was the basic that and the pettiness at the local level in a state senate race. Was pretty disillusioning to me, and so just prior to the actual election, I dropped out.
Really?
Yes, it was that, I guess, just again faced with the pettiness and the...
Well, give us an example of the pettiness you're talking about.
Well, it seemed to be most evident in just on the local level, and since I said this was a state senate position, it was in the neighborhood that there would be... grievances between one member of the neighborhood and another, and this would foist itself onto the general conversation of that.
So as candidate, you were expected to take a position one way or another, and whichever way you go, you're going to irritate somebody.
Exactly, exactly. And again, I think I probably went in with a little more idealistic thing because I had left in the 70s, in the early 70s, and, you know, disappointed with the American way, et cetera, through all of the young man foibles. And then, after being in the third world, discovered that there was no contest between other governments and ours, and ours was so superior, and came back filled with the fervor of trying to do something to further that. And... indeed, I think I probably was naive. I had not been in a campaign before and was probably not prepared for the, I guess, the obsequious.
I think way. In journalism we call those the rigors of the campaign. Ron Fauché, Nicholas's experience, I guess not a lot of people drop out just before Election Day, but people tend to know why they run. When they figure out the how, sometimes it is overwhelming.
It is.
Yes.
It is. And one of the things that that we've found in studying campaigns, of course, it can be euphoric and exciting for candidates. And like I always say, you know, 1 minute of the day when you're expecting somebody to give you $100 contribution and they give you $1,000, you feel like the master of the universe. 2 hours later, you're looking for Dr. Kevorkian's phone number when you find out that your cousin's passing out literature for the other side. So there's high ups and there's low downs. And one of the things that we studied with the Pew Charitable Trust in the University of Maryland a couple of years ago was you know, how candidates look at the campaign process. And one of the things we found was that the campaign process on candidates really puts them through a change, a metamorphosis, where they get into a campaign, they think they're going to have an opportunity to talk about important issues, to unveil a program and an agenda for the future, and they end up finding out that it's not like that at all, that political campaigns are not good forums to bring up and talk about a lot of important complex issues, and that there's enormous pressures, day-to-day pressures on candidates that sort of get them off track from where they thought they were going to be.
Nicholas, let me ask you another question. What about money? How much did this race cost you?
Well, in the in our area of the country, obviously, it's much less than I think it would be on either coast.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably not over about $10,000 that, as I said, as I dropped out of the race, we still had about $2,000, I think, left to spend, and that was going to be on a television blitz, and I was just so disillusioned with exactly what the gentleman was talking about. It's same commitment of time and lack of privacy. I remember a staggering thing that one of my workers, I guess, in the precinct had said that, why, we consider you to be our senator. We can come over there anytime. Well, the alarm went up to my privacy notice that, wait a minute, I don't want complete access by anybody.
Well, Nicholas, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You betcha.
And good luck next time around if you do it again.
I will.
Just wanted to ask you, Ron Foscia, he was talking about something in 1975, $10,000 for a state Senate seat with $2,000 left over for a television blitz.
Right.
You can't blitz a lot of TV almost anywhere in the country for
$2,000. No, I don't think so. In fact, you'd have trouble even just producing the spot on a low-cost basis. Most state legislative campaigns now, particularly for state Senate seats, depending upon where it is, can run into the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And television time is obviously hugely expensive, and then it comes with a whole accoutrement of advisors and producers, and then what are you going to make the commercial about? This
sure.
all gets very involved.
It's very complex. You have to have a strategy. You have to have creative techniques. You have to have technical proficiency. You have to buy the time the right way. You have to have the right people who produce it, the lighting, the sound, the photographs, the film work. It's more complex than people could imagine.
And another part of this that people don't imagine is, again, a lot of people know why they want to run and what issues they want to run on. As you say, during the campaign, they can get tactically shifted off the things that they want to talk about, because that may not be what the campaign turns to be about. At the same time, their primary activity, which they may not also have anticipated, is raising money.
That's true. An enormous amount of time for most candidates, unless you're personally wealthy, has to be devoted to calling people and begging people for money.
People you don't know.
Most cases, people you don't know. And sometimes it's very difficult and takes a lot of calls, a lot of meetings to get people to turn over that money.
Have you ever had an experience with a candidate who just, you know, was uncomfortable selling themselves to strangers on the phone?
Yes. In fact, most candidates don't like raising money. You know, one of the things about our modern political campaigns, people think politicians or political consultants or fundraisers or interest groups want the process to be the way it is, and they really don't. Candidates hate raising money for the most part. People who give money don't like being bothered and don't like giving money.
They feel like they're being extorted.
Sure, very much so. But there are candidates who get out of the process, as this gentleman was talking about, because they don't want to have to beg people, friends, neighbors, people they don't know for money, and they just don't want that invasion of privacy where everything they do and everything they've done is exposed to public scrutiny.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how to run for public office. If you've thrown your name into the ring, what got you to take the plunge? What were the biggest challenges of campaigning? What advice would you have for aspiring candidates? Give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Ron Foscia, veteran campaign manager, the author of Running for Office, The Strategies, Techniques, and Messages Modern Political Candidates Need to Win Elections. And let's get another caller on the line. Don is with us from Martindale, Texas.
Yes, hello.
Hey, Don.
Can you hear me okay?
You're on the air.
I've got the speakerphone.
If you'd pick that up, that'd be helpful. We'd be able to hear you much better.
You can hear me now?
Yes, if you'd pick
okay,
up the... Don, if you'd just pick up the phone and talk into the regular phone, that would be helpful.
Okay.
That's much better. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm the mayor of this little one-horse town in Texas, and I tell you that one thing that struck me after holding office, public office, is there are two things. One is how much time it takes, and you've already heard that from your other guests and callers, but also how uninformed the electorate really is. And their perceptions, how they can be skewed by very little insignificant things that will lead them to believe what they believe is somebody's good, somebody's bad, somebody's going down the wrong track. And that really surprised me, you know, how it's difficult to convey what your intentions and your direction is. And
so some dispute over a pothole on Jackson Avenue becomes the whole symbol of the campaign for some reason.
Yeah, well, that's exactly true. And it's how it affects people immediately. And the criteria they use to judge larger issues, you know, more of a global issue, is really based on just a simple little thing that's really insignificant in the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. Are you running for re-election this year?
No, I actually, one reason I called is just to explain, you've already heard from your guests how much time it takes, and I found that out too, and I'm trying to resign, but I can't find anybody that wants to take this position that I think would be suitable, and I'm not very, I haven't set too high standard. So I find like it is a tremendous energy drain, and I'm shocked at how few people are willing to step forward and take on the responsibility.
Again, I assume this is not a full-time job there in Martindale.
No, it is not. It is 24/7 though in a little town like this, because you get calls from people that want you to deal with stray dogs and potholes, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it is a full-time job.
Ron, is that a problem at all, lack of competition, particularly in smaller places around the country?
Well, I
was asking our guest here.
It's not really a problem in major offices. All the major offices seem to have a significant number of candidates running. Although one of the things we have been finding in recent years is the pressures of money, the pressures of time, the pressures of scrutiny are keeping a lot of people from running for office. We did a survey of 8,000 former political candidates and found that over 80% of the candidates themselves thought that the pressures of money and public scrutiny were keeping good people from running for office. Now, that's not ivory tower intellectuals and newspaper editorial writers saying that. That's the candidates themselves. So I think that there is something going on out there where a lot of competent, able people don't want to serve in public office anymore because they don't want to go through this difficult process to get there.
Mm. Well, Don, good luck to you, and I hope Martindale finds somebody to take your place.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call.
Okay.
Here's an email we got from Roz Rogoff in San Ramon, California. I'm running for the Dublin-San Ramon Services District, which is a local water and sewer district in the cities of Dublin and San Ramon, California. You might think I'd be unopposed. There are 5 candidates for 3 seats. All of us are highly qualified. Right now, I'm updating my website. That's what Roz is doing on this Labor Day with a list of my supporters and my platform on the issues. So there's a low-level seat that's highly competitive. Many political aspirants get their first taste of campaigning with Xerox flyers and awkward speeches of student government elections. The classroom now has a more modern way to introduce future Bushes and Kerrys to the rigors of the campaign trail. It's a computer game called A More Perfect Union.
Media Blitz, fundraiser, photo op, what will you do to win the race for U.S. Senate? A More Perfect Union, the Youth Leadership Initiative's interactive CD-ROM, puts you in the middle of the election. As campaign manager, you make all the decisions. The simulation is loaded with content on campaign strategy, political ideology, demographic analysis, the mass media, polling, and much more. A More Perfect Union, putting you on the road to a lifetime of civic participation.
Joining us now is Lee Brown, Director of Instruction at the University of Virginia's Youth Leadership Initiative, which created that game. She joins us from her home in Waynesboro, Virginia. Good of you to be with us on Labor Day.
Thanks so much for calling me.
So what are some of the challenges students have to deal with over the course of this game?
Well, the Youth Leadership Initiative is actually a project based at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. I just have to slide that in.
Okay.
And what we've tried to do is create a way to get students more actively engaged in the excitement of, you know, this time of year and this election season. And so we've built in some things for teachers, first of all, to give kids the academic background that they would need to understand the campaign process. So
the civics lesson, if you
mm-hmm.
will.
So yeah. We have, but lesson plans on really some of those core social studies skills, like being able to read tables and charts and graphs with demographic information. And once kids understand what demographics are, they can use that information to analyze the different congressional districts within the imaginary state of Franklin, where this campaign takes place, and they can figure out, well, if the population of District 3 is a little older, might be a good idea to talk about Social Security, for example. If a district has high unemployment, they're better off talking about job creation there than they would be in a place that has a lower rate of unemployment.
Does this kind of game make people more interested in running for office?
Well, I mean, that's part of our goal. The motto at the Center for politics is a good thing, and yet studies consistently show that young people increasingly don't see public service as a noble calling, as a worthwhile endeavor. And so our hope is that that kids will understand, you know, why it is that politicians talk about what they talk about, that they will feel more comfortable accessing the system, and that they'll understand, by understanding the process better, it will make them more encouraged to get involved.
Well, let's get another caller on the line, and Nancy's with us from Olem County in Kentucky.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, this is perfect. A fellow teacher, Mike Slider, is running for Congress as an independent in the 4th District of Kentucky, and we don't need a game because Mike's, no offense to your guest, but we don't need a game because Mike is, as an option in his class, offering his class to actually work on his campaign, and students from last year are basically the staffers for his campaign. I'm helping a little bit. I'm one of the other faculty members, and there are several others who are working with him, but he decided that he'd had enough and he was going to run for Congress. So he's
What if the people in his class had been either Democrats or Republicans or Green Party members? What if they wanted to work on somebody else's campaign?
I guess they could. I'm not sure exactly how he's got it set up, and I don't know. There's actually been some sort of comment about it, but I know he's got it worked out where and it may just be that they're just doing it just because they like him, and it may not be part of actual class work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he's talking about his experiences, you know, his firsthand experiences. The kids that just graduated have done the web page, for example, are running, literally running the campaign. The campaign manager is a recent, you know, just graduated this past year. One of the kids is, I know, putting together a fundraiser with a rock band. They're trying to find a place, for example, to have it, and they're doing it all.
Well, Ron Fauché, we hear a lot of that former politicians going into academe to teach government and other things. This is going the other way around, a teacher running for Congress.
Well, we see that in some places. A number of members of Congress today and started off in the university setting as teachers and members of faculty, and sometimes they tend to be very good candidates because they're very knowledgeable of issues, and they do have a core of a lot of young people and former students who will help them.
This guy is such a good guy. I would do anything for him, and I think that's a lot of what has happened. A lot of these people would do anything for him. It's a shame that the money is such an issue. He's only taking individual donations, won't take any PAC money, and I'm just sorry that money is such an issue for candidates because, as an independent, he's going to have trouble, I think. The other thing is,
Let me just ask, hold that thought just a second, but Ron,
okay.
The cost of running a congressional campaign in Kentucky, given that media market off the top of your head?
You'd probably have to spend at least $1 million to have a major
campaign. and I'm really laughing. You know what? I'm hoping that at some point that the internet might level the playing field. And reason to vote, and that's the number two in the middle. .com is the site. You know, the hope would be that kind of Howard Dean approach to fundraising, that sort of thing, might bring in some money, that sort of thing. But I think.
Well, Nancy, good luck to you, and this being a national radio program, to everyone else in the race.
Yeah, thank you. You can figure out who's running on the other side.
I think we can. Thanks very much for the call. Lee Brown, obviously it would work even better if your students could get into a real political election instead of a virtual one, but that prospect sounds pretty exciting.
Well, you know, Neil, I think that Nancy hit it right on the head, though, that probably a lot of the kids are working for their teacher because they feel a personal connection to him. And there's significant research that indicates that that's a really powerful experience for young people, that meeting a candidate or an elected official personally, tends to motivate young people, that they feel it's not just this person in Congress, it's someone I know, and that a lot of young people who do get involved in politics, it's because of some personal connection they have. You know, the oft-cited example, of course, is Bill Clinton meeting John Kennedy at Boys Nation. But, you know, in big and small ways, that plays itself out across the country. So it's wonderful that, you know, these kids are, so motivated by how they feel about their teacher to get involved with this political campaign.
Lee Brown, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Lee Brown with the Youth Leadership Initiative at the University's Virginia Center for Politics, which makes the game a more perfect union. She joined us today from her home from Waynesboro, Virginia. And let's get another caller on the line. Maureen in Oakland, Missouri.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am in my fourth term as alderman in our little community. We're a very small town, a suburb of St. Louis. There are about 1,500 people. We're about a mile square, and we have our only commercial property is a gasoline Quick Trip market here, and that's about it. And I have to say that I first ran for office without the thought of putting much effort into it. I ran unopposed. Someone in my neighborhood was no longer doing it, so would you do it? I'm tired. And I said, sure. And promptly found out how little I knew. In fact, I was afraid to open my mouth for the first 6 months because I didn't know what the heck was going on most of the time. But I did, after the first couple of times, I was opposed, and I did have to campaign in a more aggressive manner and found that to be an eye-opening experience, too. And I guess the advice I would give whoever's running for office, number one, is make sure you've got good shoes and make sure you've got clothes that are appropriate for the weather. Here, our elections are always in April, which means you need to campaign in March, and that's always very questionable as to what the weather's going to be like. But it's been quite an experience, and I have learned a lot.
Do you live your life any differently as an older woman than you used to beforehand?
I certainly do, but that implies that I've been doing a lot of things before that I would not want anybody to know about, but that's not the case. I am certainly more aware of how the things I say and do appear to people. That's been a real eye-opener. And the man who called, who was a mayor in a small town, I have to echo everything he said as far as privacy and as far as being a 24-hour job in the sense that people feel free to call you at any time. And
Ron Fauché, I guess we could have told that Don was not going to be running for re-election when he said, describe his own town as a one-horse town.
that was the giveaway.
Yeah.
So, well, Maureen, are you running for re-election?
It's next April, and I'm still wondering. I think sometime in December is the time to sign up, and I'm not sure. But I want to tell you, if you got time, one very quick story that's kind of a grassroots, what this is all about, I think. We've lived in this community, in this house, for 30 years, and I was pretty much oblivious to what went on in local politics for most of that time. Until about 10 years ago, our backyard happened to be very close to an interstate highway. I looked out my back window one day, and some huge thing was going up, and it turned out to be a billboard. I was completely taken by surprise, as was all of our neighbors, and came to, as we investigated, found out that the state of Missouri had nullified the local ordinances against billboards in communities, and our community wasn't prepared and didn't get a new one, and therefore we have a billboard now shining in our backyard. In the wintertime, it looks like there's a spaceship taking off from my house. That taught me a lot about being involved in politics and the difference that one person can make, and that you do need to pay attention. And that pretty much is is why I was even considering, or why I even listened when my neighbor said, would you be willing to do this?
Well, Maureen, thanks very much, particularly for the object lesson.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you very much for being there. We really appreciate NPR.
Oh, thank you so much. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As we've heard this hour, there are a lot of things candidates need to learn to make a successful bid for office, how to fundraise, how to craft a message, whom to target along the way. There's a lot of political lingo that candidates should pick up to really sound like they're in the electoral know, to help potential politicos parse the terminology. We turn now to Grant Barrett, the author of Hatchet Jobs and Hardball, the Oxford Dictionary of American Political Slang. Grant joins us from his home in New York City. Good of you to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
So are there a couple of terms that candidates this year ought to be familiar with?
I think when we're dealing with the local candidates, it's important to understand that in many areas, there still is a large party majority. I know that in states like Missouri, where Maureen was just calling from, there are counties that have been Democratic for 30 or 40 years. If you want to get to elected, you might be up against six or seven other candidates. So your best option might be to switch parties, which would make you what's called a rhino, a Republican in name only.
Aha, a rhino. Now, we've been talking with people running for a lot of offices. What about that apocryphal office of dog catcher? Does anybody actually run for dog catcher?
I've done some research on that. I haven't found any place where that's dog catchers do run for office. I suspect it's used strictly because it's kind of the lowest political position on the totem pole, probably somewhere below assistant vice sheriff. I don't really know.
I'm not sure we have assistant vice sheriffs. Any more of the one-hit wonders for this season?
Well, related to the rhino is what's called the post office party. And this is a party, again, in an area where, let's say, the Republicans have total control. If you want to... So you might have a county where everyone is Republican, but the state offices and the presidential office in the United States, the federal office, might be held by the other party. So there are patronage favors that will work their way down through the system and reach your county. So it's important sometimes to have a post office party, which is simply a P.O. box where any local candidates who are probably completely unsupported by their people, when they get those patronage offices, they might be postmaster.
Grant Barrett is the editor of Hatchet Jobs and Hardball. We thank him for being with us. And Ron Fauché, thank you for your time today as well. When we come back from a break, Hurricane Frances. This is NPR News.